can try to stay on time. Again, this workshop is getting accommodations and assistive technology in college and training programs. And if you want to turn to tab 5, there has my biography there. And I am Rocco Iaculo. I'm a staff attorney with the Disability Rights Network. And if you read my bio, it explains that I focus my work primarily on enforcement of the Americans with Disabilities Act, the Fair Housing Amendments Act, Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act, in trying to protect the rights of individuals with disabilities against employment discrimination, discrimination in state and local government services, in transportation, public accommodations, just to name a few. Before we get started today, I just want to make an announcement. You may, if you were at other workshops, may have heard these announcements. Participants should have received any alternative formats that were requested before the conference. If you need those alternative formatted materials today, you can ask any DRN staff for those, which will be produced and provided after the conference. The workshop is being audio recorded today. Also, again, there is a workshop survey or evaluation in the conference binder. We're going to give 10 minutes again at the end of the presentation for people to fill this out. For youth and young adults, please at least fill out the information indicating whether you're a recipient of Social Security. The Social Security Administration, which is funding this conference, is asking for the information. So please hand in these surveys at the end of the presentation. Even if you don't fill it out completely, just fill out as much as possible. You also don't need to provide your name on that if you don't want to. And for today, we're going to have some interaction. If there's any questions, please, we have a microphone available, and you can use that for any questions you might have. Okay, so this workshop, again, is entitled Getting Accommodations and Assistive Technology in College and Universities and Training Programs. What I wanted to try to go over, we do have about a half hour to try to go over this, and there is a lot of information to go over. I wanted to try to start by explaining the laws that protect students with disabilities or individuals with disabilities who are applying to colleges, universities, or any type of training program. Try to go over those requirements first and then talk a little bit about practically how should you go about either requesting accommodations or whatever other changes you might need to be able to participate fully in a college or other type of program. And then the third thing is to talk a little bit about what to do if things go wrong, where you can turn to try to get the school to do what it's supposed to do when they're not. So to get started, I'm actually going to start with the federal laws that we have on the books to protect students with disabilities. And again, this analysis is going to be a little bit different than what some of you are used to with regard to high school, because again, a lot of what you're dealing with colleges and training programs, it's a little bit more informal and things have to be initiated by the student or his family and apply for the things that the laws say that the schools have to do. And the two main laws that we have that protect students with disabilities is, again, the Americans with Disabilities Act and Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act. And there are a couple of different, actually three main sections of the ADA. And we refer to them as Title I, Title II, and Title III. Title I deals with employment discrimination, which we're not going to be talking about at this workshop. ADA Title II applies to public colleges and universities, and ADA Title III applies to private colleges and universities. And I'm going to go over some of the requirements. For the most part, the requirements under both of those titles are fairly similar, so there's not a lot of difference. There's a couple of differences that I will highlight. The second law is Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act, which applies to any recipient of federal funding. In the context of colleges, universities, and training programs, likely all such institutions are going to be covered by Section 504, regardless of whether they're public or private, because they all receive federal funding in some format, whether it be through grant monies or otherwise. And these laws provide protection to qualified individuals with disabilities. So leaving aside any accommodations that you might need, you still have to be able to meet the essential eligibility requirements for the school to be able to be admitted to those programs. So the schools can still rely on some legitimate requirements, but they may have to provide accommodations. Both of these laws, in the law itself, have a general statement against discrimination. So we all know that now after these laws, these schools or training programs cannot discriminate against you on the basis of disability. So they can't say, oh, well, we just don't want someone with a disability in our program. To everyone in this room, that's clear that, that's illegal. And the statutes provide these very general statements, again, explaining that an individual cannot be, for instance, under Title II, no qualified individual with a disability shall, by reason of such disability, be excluded from participation in or be denied the benefits of the services, programs, or activities of a public entity, in this case would be the schools, or be subjected to discrimination by any such entity. So that's just one example. I mean, they're very, very broad. Now, in Title III of the ADA, there's actually some more specific requirements and prohibitions that are set forth. ADA Title II and Section 504, they're not set forth in the statute, but they're set forth in regulations. And so I'm going to go through those right now. And to start with, again, you know, some pretty basic things that, again, the schools or training programs cannot refuse to allow a student with a disability the opportunity to participate. They cannot exclude them on the basis of disability. They cannot afford an opportunity that is not equal to non-disabled students. They must provide their programs and services in an integrated setting, unless, for some reason, the only way to provide an equal opportunity would be to provide some separate, service or benefit. And again, they're similar under both ADA and Section 504. You can also, schools cannot place surcharges, meaning they can't charge the student with a disability for the cost of measures that are necessary to ensure that they are not discriminated against and are given an equal opportunity to participate in the school. And another general prohibition is that they cannot impose eligibility criteria that screen out or tend to screen out individuals with disabilities. So again, there's some general prohibitions that both laws set out. I'm now going to talk about a couple of specific requirements, and the one first requirement is the requirement that schools have to provide reasonable modifications at different times to, again, afford an equal opportunity to individuals with a disability. The second requirement is dealing with physical accessibility requirements. So that would be for requirements for facilities to either be accessible or to make accessibility improvements. Another big area that I'm going to go over is in the area of communication. So what schools have to do to ensure effective communications with students with visual or hearing impairments. Another topic that I will go over is examinations and courses. And then I'm also going to touch on some additional specific requirements that the Section 504 regulations talk about. The first concept is pretty straightforward. What the laws say is that these schools have to make, you know, certain changes or may have to make certain changes if they're necessary to afford an equal opportunity to a student with a disability. So this could be any change in the way things that are typically done at a school, any change in policies. One big area that always comes up is, again, in the area of allowing service animals on school grounds for a student with a disability who has a service animal that assists them in doing certain things and performing certain tasks for the student. That's one area. But there's all kinds of different examples that could come up. So, again, we're talking about any change in the way things are typically done. These laws require a school to do those. Now, the only limitation on this requirement, and I might touch on it a little bit more, is if something is going to cause an undue burden or a fundamental alteration in the school's programs, services, or activities. Undue burden, you're looking at financial burdens or otherwise. In the context of, you know, post-secondary educational institutions, I think it's going to be a pretty high standard because they are receiving a lot of federal funding. So in most cases, they're probably not going to have a legitimate argument to say that something is going to be too expensive for them to do. But there could be a situation where that would arise. Fundamental alteration means that whatever you're asking them to do would, you know, so change the design and object of that specific course or program that it would just be burdensome for them to do it and interfere with their operations. Again, that's really rarely going to come up in these cases because most of the things that people are going to be asking for are going to be reasonable. So that's sort of a general statement. We'll get into more specific requirements, especially in regards to the area of communications. The second big area is the requirements for physical accessibility. Now, ADA Title II and Title III deal with physical accessibility in different ways with regard to existing facilities. And when I say existing facilities, for purposes of the ADA, that means any school buildings or facilities that were built prior to the effective date of the ADA, which was January of 1992. So if we have, you know, older colleges, universities, with regard to existing facilities, ADA Title II and Title III, there is a difference there. Under ADA Title II, for public colleges and universities, Congress allowed and developed the concept, I'm sorry, the Department of Justice in its regulations developed the concept of program accessibility. What that means is the schools cannot deny a student with a disability access to their services, programs, or activities because their facilities are not accessible. So we have a general statement again, but then it also says that it doesn't mean that that existing school has to make physical accessibility improvements to all of its facilities as long as the program as a whole is accessible to the student with a disability. So rather than, let's say there's a building on campus that is not accessible to a student with a disability or a student who uses a wheelchair, let's say it's, that we would hope that their libraries would be accessible, but let's say it's a library. Potentially under ADA Title II, if it's a public college or university, they may not be required to make that specific building accessible, but make an arrangement with that student that they could order books online, and then another student maybe, could deliver those books to their room, their dorm room, or they could meet them outside of the building to deliver those books. So that's a possibility. Obviously, because of the integrated setting requirement, there is a lot of support to say, well, maybe you should make changes or should have made changes to the library to make it physically accessible. But it's not clear that they always are going to have to make those accessibility improvements as long as there's an effective alternative. Sure. Again, not necessarily with regard to installing an elevator, but they would have an obligation to move that classroom down to the first floor. So that's, again, under ADA Title II, this concept of program accessibility, which is a little bit more lenient, and I think the intent was, or the understanding was, that with regard to public facilities, there was probably a lot more public facilities that were much older, and there was a compromise made there because they understand that there could be extremely high costs in making public entities alter and make physically accessible all of their facilities. Now, the difference under ADA Title III, again, when we're dealing with private colleges and universities, is that there actually is what is called the readily achievable barrier removal standard. Now, this applies to existing facilities and was a requirement beginning on the effective date of the ADA to the present time, which, and that standard is that private colleges and universities must remove architectural barriers and communication barriers that are structural in nature in existing facilities where such removal is readily achievable. And from our standpoint, that has been an affirmative obligation that they had to do that regardless of whether they had a student with a disability approach them and say, I need a physical accessibility improvement. They're just supposed to be doing that. Now, the reality is, both in the context of private colleges and universities and many other private establishments, is that a lot of places have not done that. And that it just ends up that when someone with a disability approaches them, that's when the issue is raised. But they're supposed to be doing that. Now, the readily achievable standard means that they have to take any action that is easily accomplishable and able to be carried out without much difficulty or expense. Some examples that the regulations state are readily achievable are things such as installing ramps and curb cuts, rearranging tables, chairs, vending machines, or furniture, let's say in a dorm room or something like that to make it accessible, widening doorways, installing accessible door hardware, installing grab bars in restrooms, creating accessible parking spaces. So there's just some examples. There's a lot of examples where things are pretty clearly going to be readily achievable. And again, they're supposed to be doing those. Now, where the private college or university can demonstrate that the removal of a barrier is not readily achievable, then they still have an obligation to, again, make an alternative arrangement. So, again, in the situation with the classroom being on the third floor, having to install an elevator likely is not going to be considered readily achievable. Again, depending upon the circumstances, you know, if it's going to cost, you know, $70,000, $80,000 to put that elevator in, it may not be readily achievable. But then instead they would have to look at, can we do something else? And sure, they could move it to a first floor classroom and accommodate the student in that fashion. So it's a little bit different under when you're dealing with private colleges and universities because they were required to take some architectural or make some architectural improvements. Now, when we're dealing with... Sure.
I have a question. I was in college at a private university. And my question is, I was in college at a private university, and a good friend of mine had a physical disability, and all the buildings were accessible except for one, which was actually classified as a historical building, and they wouldn't make any changes, and they did accommodate as far as having classes she was taking in buildings she could get into, but she couldn't get into, like, the bursar's office, the registrar's office, or anything like that, because they were all in this building and they couldn't change the building. They couldn't put in elevators or anything because of it being a historical building. So I'm just wondering, like, what are the options in that case?
I think since it's a private college and university, actually 88 Title II sets forth a specific regulation dealing with historic properties. Now, that's pretty stringent. The property or building has to be on the list of, it's like the National Register of Historic Properties. Like,
yeah,
it actually has to be. In the private colleges and universities, the regulations don't speak to that specifically, so it would just be under the standard readily achievable barrier removal standard.
Right.
And I think that's where the analysis would come into play, and they might argue that it's not readily achievable because to take these actions would take away from the historic nature of the building. So it's an interesting question, you know, because there is not a specific regulation on it, so it might fall under the readily achievable, but I'm not aware of specific case law dealing with it in a private context. So they may not have to do that, but if there's offices that are providing substantial services to students that need to be available to students with disabilities as well, I mean, they need to come up with an alternative, either moving those offices to another accessible building and using that building for something else.
Right.
I think that you can make a good argument that they need to move those to another accessible location because it's something that needs to be readily available to students to all students and students with disabilities. So. It's an unfortunate situation. Did they try to accommodate the students in any way?
I guess that they would talk to them on the phone or whatever, but I mean, or meet them somewhere on campus that was accessible, but they never did move the offices. So, you know, they couldn't get to the registrars, they couldn't get to bursars. Some professors' offices were located in that building on the second or third floor, and there was just no way you could show up for office hours or anything.
Sure. I mean, I think, you know, it's a tough call, I think, as long as they were making alternative arrangements to meet the students somewhere else. That was probably okay. But I guess my point is if they have a lot of services there that need to be readily available to all students, I think they should have really made taken a long look at that and tried to move that to a more accessible building. But they may not have been required to absolutely do it, but I think it would have been a good idea. Okay, I'm going to try to, because we're kind of short on time, so I'm going to try to go through some of these other things as quickly as possible. New construction and alterations, that's pretty high standard. Anything that's built brand new has to be built readily accessible and usable by individuals with disabilities, including students who use wheelchairs. So that's pretty straightforward and pretty stringent, so they have to be fully accessible. Now I want to move on to requirements for communications. Under both the ADA and Section 504, it's pretty clear that these schools have to take any steps that are necessary to ensure that no individual with a disability is excluded, denied services, segregated, or otherwise treated differently than other individuals because of the absence of auxiliary aids and services. And related to that, they have to ensure that communication with persons with hearing, vision, or speech disabilities are as effective as communication with others. So when we're talking about auxiliary aids and services, many of you may understand what that term means. That could be providing sign language interpreters to students who are deaf, captioning services, again, to students with either hearing impairments or who are deaf, providing magnification equipment for, you know, students with visual impairments or other assistive technology devices to have access to the school's computer services, things like that. They can also are not allowed to charge the student with a disability who needs those auxiliary aids and services for the cost of providing those services. As a quick example, I mean, I had a recent intake where a student at a private small college needed captioning services for all of her classrooms because she had a significant hearing impairment, and she met some difficulty with the school in getting those services. We were able to get involved, and the cost that the school thought they were facing when they contacted a private captioning agency was I think the cost was going to be about $20,000 per semester for six semesters. So we're talking about a lot of money. I mean, maybe $150,000. So I think the school, that's why they were a little uneasy. We were luckily able to find the services of someone who was a freelance captioner who services were much cheaper than that, and we were able to work it out with the school that they were going to pay her. So it was still going to be a significant sum of money to pay her. In our opinion, you know, we wanted to try to reach a quick resolution for the student, so that's why we wanted to find something cheaper. However, we still could have made a pretty good argument that they still would have been required to even expend the $150,000 over the course of that program for the student, and that that would be required by the law. But that we ended up working it out, and they provided captioning services. So they have to provide those types of things at no cost to the student. Now, dealing with specifically with examinations and courses during these programs, they also have to make reasonable modifications to exams. Let's say a student with a learning disability needs extra time to take their exams. The law requires them to provide those types of modifications to examinations. With regard to courses, they might also be required to make certain modifications. And when I'm talking about courses, let's say you're going to school, you're majoring in history, and you have to meet certain, take certain classes within a certain time frame to get your degree in history. They are may be required to make modifications such as giving a student more time to complete the degree requirements, maybe substituting certain classes that for whatever reason might be more difficult with the student. They might be required to do that. Sometimes it gets a little iffy with those types of requests for modifications because, again, it goes up against the thing where the law makes clear that they don't have to waive essential eligibility requirements. So if it's an essential requirement, they may not have to waive that or substitute it. But if it's something where they there's no reason why a certain course could be substituted, they might have to do something like that. Again, they also have to provide auxiliary aids and services to help students take examinations or for their classes that falls under course requirements as well. Anything to aid a student with a disability to be able to complete their degree requirements. There is a question in the back.
Yeah, real briefly.
Sure.
What if the student has a communication disorder? Like he's on the autism spectrum. Can you ask the college to provide either a life coach or a peer mentor? Is that considered a reasonable accommodation for a communication disorder?
That is a good question. And there's another exemption under the law that I didn't speak about. That the regulations are pretty clear, at least within the ADA, that private or public colleges and universities are not required to provide services that are of a personal nature. It is likely that the things that you're asking about could fall within the definition of a personal service. Now, I know that there are a lot of schools, even the college I went to, because my wife had told me, I went on to law school, my wife was still at college, and they had a student who was on the football team who was injured in a car accident, and he was paralyzed. And he wanted to come back to school. And they actually set up a program where they had students helping him. He wanted to live on campus. They had other students actually helping him in his dorm room with even, you know, bathing and things like that and helping him to live independently on campus. Now, taking a look at that, the ADA is pretty clear that the school probably didn't have to go that far, but that school was willing to try to arrange something. So while it may not be legally required, it's something that you might want to try to talk to the school about if you're in that situation to see what they might be willing to do. Because, again, nothing says that they're not allowed to go above and beyond what the law requires. Sure.
I have a follow-up to that question, which is, what about services such as note-taking? Let's say that the issue is more related to handwriting or processing in a way to be able to take notes along those lines.
Yes, the school would be required to provide note takers for a student with a disability if that was an effective accommodation for them in the classroom. And a lot of times what the schools will end up doing is, you know, trying to find another student that the student with a disability is comfortable with in taking those notes, or they could just designate another student to do that, but they would be required to do that. That falls under the guise of auxiliary aids and services. Another area that comes up, we had a recent case that causes a lot of problems for professors, and that's what's happening in this case. The ADA coordinator at the school was fine with the accommodation, where the student has a learning disability that causes her to not be able to process written information as well as her auditory processing is better, and she wanted to have the ability to tape record all of her classrooms. Well, the ADA coordinator was okay with it. She started having problems with a particular professor who was concerned about I'm not really sure what he was concerned about, but concerned that his voice was on the tapes and what was going to happen with the tapes and other students' voices were on the tapes. Well, the law in Section 504 talks about this, that that's not a valid reason to disallow taping of classrooms. They have to allow that if it's necessary for that student with a disability. Now, they can work out reasonable arrangements that maybe after a certain period of time where the classroom is or the class is done and the student doesn't need those tape recordings any longer, that they, you know, maybe need to give them back to the professor or something. That might be reasonable, but they have to allow an accommodation even such as that. So that would also be reasonable.
Sure. Yes, I have a question. Is it true that the student has to have been taking advantage of all these accommodations for the last 2 years in high school to be eligible for these to be considered in college?
No. The issue with that is that with regard to colleges and universities, when the disability is not obvious and the need for the accommodation, therefore, is not obvious, they are allowed to request documentation, including medical documentation, for the need for the accommodation and limit it to what the specific disability is. So where that might come up, a lot of times people try to provide evidence to the college and university, for instance, for extra time on exams. It would be helpful if in high school they also received extra time on exams, and it would make your case much stronger because then you can point to that evidence to the college and say, look, here is my son or daughter's disability. They received the same exact accommodations in high school. It was, you know, authorized by the school, and she continues to need that accommodation. It helps, but you know, it's not something where that absolutely is needed. It's just if a student has never gotten a certain accommodation ever before, and then they go to the college and say, well, I need it now, you're just going to have to come up with very specific documentation to provide evidence that there is a need now for that accommodation. So it just makes it may make it a little bit more difficult for you to get the accommodation, but that's not an absolute requirement to say you have to have had certain accommodations within the last 2 years to now get them in college.
I believe that in order to get extended time through the College Board for SATs, that on the application it does say, have you had these kind of accommodations in high school? And that's different because College Board is a private organization and they have the right. So you can provide all your documentation, but it is a question that they ask on the form.
Sure, and we get a lot of calls about that issue as well. And I think it's the same. It's not foolproof saying that if you never had those accommodations before, you can't get them on the SAT, but it just makes the argument more difficult. So, kind of, we only have a few minutes here before we really, I'm actually supposed to give you 10 minutes for the survey, but if it's okay with you, I'm going to give you 5 minutes, so I have four more minutes to talk a little bit more.
Can I ask one quick question, please? Just one quick question.
Sure.
It's in regard to this young lady's question, the autistic support programs for the autistic children.
Yes.
I've been doing my own research and own networking, trying to find out which, do you have a list of colleges that has a program already set up for children of disabilities getting ready to go into the transition? I know Bluebell. Community College in Bluebell, Pennsylvania, Montgomery County Community College has a program set up. I was just wondering, is there any other colleges or community colleges in a list that more or less are dedicated to or dealing with the children with disabilities? Some
you know,
have separate programs.
You know, I don't believe that we have a list of schools like that, but I actually really appreciate that comment because I think it's something that we could look into actually trying to put together to see if...
Or maybe a website or something.
Sure. Yeah, rating system is going to be a little bit more work, but at least having... schools, maybe identifying that they have an ADA coordinator or something like that. That's something that maybe we could work on and, you know, eventually get in, like, our publications and our on our website. So we
Thank
can
you.
Try to look into that. Sure.
Tell you which schools...
Okay, I just want to go through a couple of things just so I can touch on things that just to let you know. I mean, I'm kind of cutting short the federal requirements because there's also requirements for them to not discriminate in all aspects of college life, whether it be housing, admissions, physical education, athletics, social organizations, things like there's all kinds of requirements. But I also want to mention that there are some state laws and regulations that also govern this. Now, historically, we have relied on the federal laws more often because they do seem to be a little bit more stringent and have some more specific requirements, but they are out there, and that's either the Pennsylvania Human Relations Act, schools would be covered as public accommodations, but there is also the Pennsylvania Fair Educational Opportunities Act that, again, has a lot of similar requirements to the ADA. And then there are some specific regulations, again, that sort of mirror the ADA. Now, with regard to advocating for your rights, the best thing with dealing with having a, you know, yourself going, applying as a student with a disability or a family member, helping a student with a disability applying to these types of programs is really to try to identify whether the school has a specific ADA coordinator or someone who is supposed to handle requests for accommodations. Because I would hope that by this point, most colleges and universities are going to have such a person. So it's very good, even early in the application process. Yes, there are certain things that says schools are not allowed to ask about disabilities and applications and admissions. However, a lot of times, when you want information up front, so when you're applying, it's best to try to find out about it way ahead of time. So that's one key thing. The other thing is that if you are ever having difficulty with the school, to ask them whether there's an internal grievance process, because, again, that's a legal requirement. They're supposed to have a grievance process where you can, with the school, where you can file a complaint and have it heard by, you know, either a board within the school or something or someone else to review that. So that's also important to take advantage of. If you're still not getting any cooperation, then you need to contact either the Disability Rights Network or any other disability organization who might be able to provide you assistance with that situation. Ultimately, if you know you're still not getting anywhere, you also have the options to file complaints with the Department of Justice. And some of the materials that I left with you that are in the book have all those processes where you can file complaints, how to do that with the Department of Justice, with the U.S. Department of Education, Office of Civil Rights. They cover ADA Title II and Section 504, again, which is going to cover most schools. And also filing complaints with the Pennsylvania Human Relations Commission under the state laws. That information is in the binder, and ultimately we all hope that it never gets to that point, but at the end of the road there is the opportunity to file a federal lawsuit if it gets that bad. And you can get relief through that by making the school provide the accommodation that you're requesting or not discriminate against you. You can only get compensatory damages under Section 504, let's say lost tuition or things like that, monetary losses. You can recover under Section 504, not the ADA. But then you can also recover attorney's fees. So, again, we don't want to get to that point, but that is out there as well. So now I've really cut your survey time short, but with that, I appreciate everyone attending, and I hope it was informational for everyone and helpful. All right, take care.
You should all have survey sheets in your binders. If you do not, let us know. We have some extras up here. Thank you.